Today's guest, Robin Wright, said of her last book, Dreams and Shadows, quote, "My goal was to probe deep inside societies of the Middle East for the emerging ideas and players that are changing the political environment in ways that will unfold for decades to come." And now, just 3 years later, her new book, Rock the Casbah, tells the stunning personal stories behind the rejection of both autocrats and extremists in the Muslim world. She describes the new phase of the Islamic activism as a counter-jihad. For some, it's about reforming the faith. For others, it's overhauling political systems. But she says that for all, it's about basic rights on their own terms and not necessarily based on Western models. Muslims are now confronting extremism and rescuing their faith from a virulent minority, thereby taking charge of history and doing what the West cannot. Robin Wright has reported from more than 140 countries on six continents for numerous news organizations, including several years with the LA Times. She won the Overseas Press Club Award for Best Reporting in Any Medium, requiring exceptional courage and initiative for her work during the Angolan War. She's been a fellow with the U.S. Institute of Peace, Brookings Institution, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Yale, Duke, Stanford, etc. She's the author of five books, and her latest is Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Welcome again, Robin Wright.
It's always nice to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. As you may know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we're going to talk about. So in this day when news organizations are cut foreign budgets to the bone and pundits and opinions seem to take up more and more of the space formerly given to reporters, you call yourself a street reporter. What do you mean by that? How does it impact like a book like Rock the Casbah? And what do these changes mean for the public?
Well, I'm a street reporter in the sense that I literally, when I go out to any of the countries in the region, I take to the streets first rather than trying to talk just to the officials or to the Western embassies there, which are good at analyzing things but don't always have access to the streets. And that's why I think they missed what was happening in the Middle East with this eruption of pro-democracy movements. And I've had a wonderful time doing it. That's my tactic for 40 years in covering the world's most volatile region, and it really helps to have that person-to-person connection, particularly now that two-thirds of the populations in each of these countries is under 30. We're talking about people who are also out on the streets.
Okay. You have been investigating the seeds of reform in the Middle East for years. I mean, you've been covering it for 40 years, but you and I have been talking in some sense about this subject for maybe the last five or six. And you wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. I'm going to quote a little bit of it because it was back in March 2008, which is now 3.5 years ago. And it was titled, "Why Have New Hope for the Mideast?" Some quotes. "In the early 21st century, a budding culture of change is creatively challenging the status quo and the extremists. New public voices, daring publications, noisy protests across 24 countries are giving shape to a vigorous, if disjointed, search for alternatives to the autocratic regimes and imperious monarchies that have proved they're out of sync with their people." This, again, is March 2008. "The issue in the Middle East is no longer whether to seek political change, but how to make it happen." And then you say, "Two decades ago when I roamed the region, I sought out clandestine cells as the barometer of opposition. Now I look for computer nerds. They personify lesson one in the changing Middle East. The opposition is more open, ambitious, imaginative, and stubborn than ever. And the YouTube generation have become a whole new political class." That was March 2008. Did things move even more quickly than you expected?
Well, I could never have predicted that a young street vendor in Tunisia, and in a remote Tunisian town at that, would become so disgusted with the level of corruption and government abuse that he would set himself on fire in protest. That was the trigger, literally, the spark that ignited this wave of movements, first in Tunisia, then Egypt, now Libya, but we also see it in Syria, Yemen, we've seen it in Bahrain. There is no country of the 22 Arab countries that will not be affected by this, not have their systems change in some way. So, I had been trying to say for a long time that the dynamics in the region have changed, not just because of, bin Laden and Islamic extremism, but because there was actually something trying to fight both extremism and the autocrats that rule. Those have been the two forces that have defined the region for 30 years.
Okay. I'm going to read another quote of yours. I sometimes feel as if I finally reached the climax, although not the end, of an epic book that has taken 4 decades to read. What are you saying there?
Well, that's in my new book.
Yeah.
And I'm pleased that you've done such wonderful homework on my book. I'm very impressed. But I do think that this is kind of the beginning of the beginning, that we've seen this building now for, as you point out, 5 or 6 years, and now we've seen the explosion. But the process of transformation is going to be far longer, far messier, far more troubling to those in the West than simply the 18 days it took to oust Hosni Mubarak in Egypt or the 30 days to oust President Ben Ali in Tunisia. This is a process that will require an enormous amount of formation of new rules to govern a state, new parties to run for office, bringing in people who've often never been involved in politics before. And so this is a generational process. I mean, I often point out that in the Soviet Union, a decade later, now Russia, you still have a former communist and KGB spy chief in power. And then in South Africa, a generation after Nelson Mandela's noble walk to freedom, that the majority of blacks are worse off economically, and in some cases politically, well, not completely, but, you know, there are still political problems in South Africa. So we're looking at something that's going to play out certainly for the next generation, at least in the Middle East.
You have said that that there's a three-part shift, kind of, this going on, one in the Middle East right now or in the Muslim world. One is uprisings. Two, you term counter-jihad. And three is a rebellion versus Islamic theology. I think two things. One, we don't hear enough about that that point of view. Two, obviously there's a lot going on. Can you take those three? I mean, obviously, the uprisings is what we hear about. What do you mean by counter-jihad?
The counter-jihad has both political and cultural aspects, but it is an attempt to challenge the extremist ideologies and the extremist movements that have been so troubling, not just to our lives in the West, but also in their own lives. So many of these movements have emerged in context of Al-Qaeda strikes in Iraq or in Morocco or in other countries. And they paid a price. For example, in Iraq, we've lost over 200 people since the U.S. invasion in 2003 to suicide bombers. The Iraqis have lost over 12,000 and another 30,000 to injuries from suicide bombs alone. So that's, you know, the impact of extremism goes far beyond our experience on 9/11, and that's where the counter-jihad is trying to reclaim Islam as a peaceful religion, and it's also being very creative in how it argues among other Muslims, that this is not the wave of the future. They do it through the new Muslim comedians, playwrights. Rap has become the rhythm of the resistance. Hip-hop singers have often, in many countries, used their lyrics to challenge the regimes in ways that no politician would have ever done. So the counter-jihad plays out in lots of creative ways, and that's as important as the uprisings on the street, because it shows you how deep this sentiment is across the board.
Yeah, and what it says to me is a subject which we will talk about, and which you've referred to a little bit, which is, you know, what happens next? How do these things unfold? If there is, aside from the uprising, this counter-jihad against violent political activism, that bodes well. Let me read a quote which I loved from your book. In 2009, Khaled Al-Mayna, the editor of Arab News, told you, "Every mother in Saudi Arabia or any other Gulf country wants her son or daughter to carry a laptop rather than a rifle or a dagger." That, to me, was that just said it in so many words.
Exactly. And it was interesting to me how even in Saudi Arabia, that provided, I think, 15 of the 19 suicide bombers on the 9/11 attacks, that there's a sentiment that is growing to do things, again, creatively, proactively against extremism, so that it doesn't discredit Islam as a religion or the people who live in these countries.
Okay, and obviously, as I think I've mentioned, it seems to me that's something, that sentiment, that wave is something that more of America, more Americans need to know about, so that the shift that you see over there in terms of Islam finally makes it into people's consciousness over here. You then say that there's a third force, which is this rebellion against Islamic ideology, that sort of ideology most typified by Iran. I think this would be, again, a hopeful sign for many Americans to know about.
It's very hopeful. At the same time, it's also clear that even as they reject the rigid theocracy of Iran or the religious rule in other countries, that they're not necessarily saying to those of us in the outside world, we want to replicate or imitate everything you've done politically. They're really looking for kind of different blend of democracy and their own cultural and religious idioms. You know, they're looking.
Yeah.
So it's not, we have to understand that this is a period where, in part in response to our intervention in Iraq and, you know, foreign intervention dating back to Napoleon in Egypt, that many people in the region are saying it's time for us now to take action into our own hands and define our own future. And that's what makes this period so different from any of the other uses of Islam or the other challenges to political rule of the past 30, 35 years.
And so we will talk about, you know, what comes forward. But one thing that is a special treat of your book, and it goes back to, as you said, your style of reporting, which is a street reporter, is the stories of individuals. And I would like you to tell us some of those. A very brief one, the Egyptian camel driver who worked at the pyramids.
Yes, and this is where we get into what happens next. This is the tragic story of someone who supported the uprising, but then found that the economy couldn't improve, didn't provide, that tourism dried up. And as a result, he had the painful ordeal of trying to figure out how to feed his family without an income and also feed his camel. And his conclusion was that he might have to feed his camel to his family. That the cushion that some of these people, or many of these people, have had in the aftermath of political change has evaporated, and they're increasingly discontent. And the dangers for all of us down the road is that these movements will be derailed or diverted because the new systems don't provide either the political or economic spoils of political change, that they are not perceived, the new regime and the new political players are seen as not being able to deliver what the revolutions were all about. We keep thinking it's just to get rid of an autocrat, but in fact, it's very much also that famous slogan, it's the economy.
Right, right. I mean, one thing that it seems to me is that you have this massive demographic shift, which I think to people in America would be amazing. Give us a couple of statistics about the youth population over there.
Well, the youth population constitutes two-thirds of the 300 million people in the region, all under 30. And it's reflected in a place like Saudi Arabia, where the average age is in the mid-20s, 25, 26. The average age of the cabinet minister is 65, and the king is 87, his heir apparent is 83, and the next in line is in his late 70s. That we're not talking simply about a generation gap. We're talking about two or three generation gaps. And it reflects in Saudi Arabia the disconnect between those in political elites who rule the country and the majority of the people. And while Saudi Arabia may well be the last one to change, the need to address concerns of the people was reflected when the king came back from surgery in the United States in March and injected $136 billion into the economy simply to help create jobs, help give credit for housing loans so that young people could marry and move into their own homes, whether it was literacy and sport clubs, to try to give Saudis, particularly young Saudis, a sense of, of a future and of opportunity. So the youth are, for the first time, really challenging the not just the old boys, but the whole political environment. And it's striking that this one Tunisian street vendor helped ignite what happened in Egypt and all these other waves, even though they're vastly different political systems, whether they're oil-rich monarchies or military dictatorships, whether they're, you know, wealthy countries or pitifully poor, as in Yemen, that you see the same kind of thing happening in so many countries.
Yeah, and where I was going with the demographic question was that the demographic shift, the technological shift, the ability to communicate so quickly and easily, but what it seems finally tipped it for that street vendor was not political idealism. It was hunger, economics, and corruption. And that as I think we've been saying, the changes in government, the changes in leadership will still be faced with those enormous demographic and economic problems. And as you point out, instability cuts into the one of the reliable sources of income, which is tourism. So in other words, what we're saying is things have changed, but the deep root of the need that individuals feel, which is to feed their families and feel some hope, is a very tough nut to crack.
It sure is, and it's going to be a real problem for the new regimes. You take a look at Egypt, where you have 85 million people, very few natural resources. I mean, most people live along a very narrow strip at the side of the Nile River, and the governments are across the region, but particularly Egypt, are unable to provide for anything, really, for their people. And the military that took over after Hosni Mubarak left office has also not even lifted emergency law, hasn't announced formally what the dates for election, which are technically supposed to begin in November. There's an awful lot of things that they haven't been able to do, and I think makes this period of change vulnerable. You're absolutely right that ideology was never part of it. It was, and neither was Israel nor the United States. This was really a combustible internal phenomena.
You know, and I must say, it's apples and oranges, but I see echoes, actually, in the United States, in which you had an enormous youth vote elect a black president, which is, you know, it's not as big as the changes over there, but quite, well, certainly unprecedented, with the hope for change, but the economic problems that may have led those youth to vote in numbers that they, and organize in numbers that they never had before, are still with us 3 years later, make our political situation very unpredictable for the same reasons.
I think that's very true, and we've already seen the kind of people power explosion that we saw in the Middle East play out in Britain, for example.
Yep.
And in Greece over the debt crisis that we're, you know, the Arab Spring, as they call it, it may well be replicated in a lot of other places.
I think one of the most interesting, and you pointed out yourself, is that the Israelis have been actually modeling the Arab awakening.
In terms of their own domestic discontent, yes.
Yes, again, not about Palestine, but about economics.
That's right. And the Israelis have protested. I think one of the numbers went as high as 450,000 people.
And this is a country of, am I correct, what? How many million Israel?
I think it's around 6 million.
Yeah, so nearly half a million demonstrators at one time in a country of 6 million. That's one out of every 12 people in the country.
It's quite extraordinary, and it's only beginning. You know, the relationship between the debt crisis that we face or economic issues we face throughout the world right now and what's going on in the Middle East among Arab countries are very much connected. And there's so much hope in the explosion of protest movements, and yet there is so much vulnerability because nobody can deliver what people expect. And that may lead to whether it's you know, more profound challenges, disillusionment, the emergence of Muslim political parties or Islamist political parties, because they are seen as being more honest about delivery of basic services, involved in less corruption. So this is a the next decade will be even more difficult and tumultuous than the last decade was.
And it seems to me, I mean, just, you know, maybe I'm being short-sighted, but it seems to me the next year, 2 year, 3 year is, I mean, very often, whether it was the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution in 1917, the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the revolution follows a two-stage process. There's a people's uprising that overthrows a despot. Then as things sort themselves out over the next several months or years, new leadership emerges, but that gets overthrown, and there we are in autocracy.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, in Iran, which was one of the two pillars of U.S. policy for decades, the uprising, the revolution was hijacked a year and a half in. Initially, there were technocrats who were running the country.
Yeah, I think most people forget that. The first, as you say, year and a half of the Iranian revolution, it wasn't our Shah, but it seemed to be the people's revolution.
And the clerics actually went back to their seminaries. And it was only in the process of writing the Constitution when the division, political divisions among the opposition, the revolutionaries, began to emerge. And they began to, some of the movements even engaged in killing each other. There were over 1,000 officials killed during that year and a half, including a prime minister, 27 members of parliament, judges, right across the board. And that's when the clergy said, we have to step back in to be the supervisors of the political process. And they have been the major power in Iran ever since.
But as I think you point out, when they first stepped in, again, it wasn't viewed as an autocratic takeover. When they first stepped in, they were going to serve an advisory capacity because of the instability in the internecine warfare.
Exactly. So this is why the elections that are upcoming in both Tunisia and Egypt are important, but they're not going to be the keys to the future. It is the process of writing the Constitution that creates a new state, a new social contract between the government and its people that will be so critical in determining what happens next.
What is the status right now of I know that when you look back at Iran and it was the when it comes to rewriting a constitution, suddenly little differences that didn't matter in the square become critical. Now we're really jostling for power. How Islamic will the law be? You know, what will be the role of parties? What will be the role of women and so on? What is the status in Egypt right now? I know some countries attempt to do an election before a constitution. Some will try to do a constitution before an election.
That's precisely right. And one of the big challenges was, or has been, which comes first, the election for parliament or the constitution. And many of the protesters wanted a new constitution and then an election, for fear that the new parties didn't have enough of a backing, didn't have the resources, didn't have the name recognition that either the Islamic parties or members of the ruling party that has been disbanded but will, you know, clearly try to run candidates, that those parties have. And so
in other words, thinking that they would have a greater opportunity in an election because they already have organization.
Well, they have a little bit of an organization, but they wanted the most of the protesters wanted a constitution first, because that would.
Yeah, no, that's what I was saying. That the Muslim Brotherhood, for instance, or the remaining folks who are claiming to be rehabilitated from the power structure would have an advantage in an electoral system.
Yes.
Yeah. So where does that stand right now?
Well, the government has indicated that there may be a multi-phase election between mid-November, about the 21st, into January, and that then they would write the Constitution, the new members of Parliament. So this still has to be sorted out. And I think it's one of the kind of appalling things is that 9 months after Hosni Mubarak was ousted, they haven't lifted martial law.
Right.
And it's very difficult to run for office when you don't have basics like an election law. How do you run? How do you register your party? How do you can't get out and campaign until the election law has been promulgated or announced, and that hasn't happened yet.
And whose role would it be to put forth such a law? Would it be the military who are now in control?
The Supreme Council is in political control, and they are the initiators of all of the major government actions. There will be an election commission that may have a big role in this, but even the election commission isn't quite as clear as it should be at this stage of Egypt's transition.
Okay.
This all should have happened much earlier.
Of course. And Tunisia?
Tunisia is a little bit more advanced. They're talking about elections in October. They don't have a martial law system like Egypt does, and some new parties have emerged. So Tunisia doesn't face the obstacles that Egypt does. Maybe the most interesting country to follow is actually Libya.
I was just going to move to them, yes. Those are the three that have toppled so far, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And there's still ongoing violence on a regular basis in Syria and Yemen.
Right.
And the Yemeni security forces actually opened fire on protesters today and killed over 26 people. That was at the last count. But Libya's interesting because of the 22 Arab countries, it's the only one with a small enough population, only 6.5 million people in a very large state, and enormous oil wealth. And so they can get back to reconstruction and creating a new government. They also had five months of this transitional national council running the show, at least in half the country, and they had to deal with whether it was dealing with foreign policy and the Europeans and the Americans, or whether it was simply picking up garbage service. They have had to grapple with those issues. And so Libya is in many ways better positioned than either Egypt or Tunisia.
Okay. Dalia Ziada in Egypt.
Yes, she's one of my favorite characters. And the arc of her narrative is so interesting. She began at the age of 8 as an activist in her family. Her mother asked her to put on a party dress because they were going for a special commemoration. And it turned out that this was her circumcision. And over 80% of girls, both Muslim and Christian, are circumcised in Egypt, even though it's been formally outlawed and condemned by the clerics of all faiths. But it's a tradition going back millennia. And so she started arguing with her father and her uncles to save her sister and cousins. And she failed and failed and failed until she got to the last cousin, and she stayed up with her uncle all night to make the case against hurting her cousin. And she thought she'd failed again. And the next morning he called her and said, okay, I won't put her through this. And she decided if she could affect one person's life like that, that maybe there were others. And she got, as she grew older, deeply into the human rights movement. And she found out about a comic book on Martin Luther King's life, particularly his walk to freedom in Montgomery, Alabama. And she translated that into Arabic. And in the back were several hints about how you engage in peaceful civil disobedience. And, of course, that's what makes this change in the region so profound. It's the world's most volatile region. Suicide bombers have, killed thousands, tens of thousands of people. And yet it is the peaceful protest that turned out to be more effective. She also then went on and organized the first Arab Human Rights Film Festival and overcame enormous obstacles with the censorship board blocking her. The theater had its permit lifted, so she didn't have any place to show it. So she and friends hired a Nile riverboat cruiser used for tourists. And as soon as the boat took off from the dock, they showed their film so the government couldn't stop them. And she was in Tahrir Square every night making the case against Hosni Mubarak, even though she's a traditional female. She wears a scarf, but she's a blogger and an activist. And she announced to me last week that she's going to run for parliament.
Excellent. So that's
at 29 years old.
And her activism, as you say, started at the age of 8,
yes,
just within her own personal family. I want to do a few more of those individuals, but let's stick with one thing you mentioned there, that here she is, a radical for change who wears the hijab, right? And sure. I'm going to read a couple of quotes of yours. The two engines of change in the region are youth, because of the demographics, and women, because for the first time, the majority of them are literate in every country. 40 years ago, almost no women wore the hijab, and today, over 80% wear it. What is that about? What is the pink hijab generation?
That's a good question. It's very interesting to see the young women who are activists not wearing black, but they'll wear particularly pink, but they'll wear sequins and feathers. It's quite amazing how they've become fashionable even as they are conservative. And I think that it shows something that's really important, that the next decade will be as much about political change and political opening as it is Islamic. Not the kind of Islam we've seen in Iran or in Saudi Arabia, but using Islam as a means to an end. That it's that comfortable space where people feel that they, particularly the women, can operate without, you know, compromising their values and still promote, work very hard to promote change, political change. So I find it very interesting the number of women who are wearing these bright, colorful scarves, and they'll even wear them in different types, not just tied under the chin, but they'll take the ends and put them, craft them into a big bun in the back, and they call that the Spanish wrap because it's modeled on the flamenco dancers.
Wow. Let me go to another one, El General in Tunisia.
Yes, again, another great story. El General is a rapper. He is one of the young hip-hop artists, and he was critical in the build-up to the uprisings. Hip-hop was outlawed in Tunisia. They couldn't perform in public, couldn't record, couldn't appear on state-controlled media, radio or television. So he wrote a song that was scathing about the regime, charging that people were now living, feeding themselves off garbage on the streets, that the police were corrupt and that there was no one to protect them, that the ruling family had hoarded the wealth of the nation. Very blunt criticism. Because he couldn't put it on the internet generally, he put it on his Facebook page, which the Tunisian government couldn't censor. And 20% of Egyptians are on Facebook. And by word of mouth, they then spread things other ways. But it was in this climate, in the run-up to the uprisings in Tunisia, that this song became very popular. And after the uprising began, after the fruit vendor set himself on fire, his song, which is a wonderful song, became the anthem, and people were singing it on the streets. They then sang it in Egypt and later in Bahrain, that the rappers are really the rhythm of resistance and charging, taking the abuses of government and giving them public exposure, mobilizing people effectively.
And one of the things I hear in that one, as you were saying, if people couldn't quite get the chronology of that, is that El General and his song is on Facebook underground before the fruit vendor sets himself on fire. That there's, in other words, what we're seeing is there's a tinder or some, you know, there's a foundation built that then when the match strikes is there ready to go up in flames.
Exactly.
In a positive way. How about, because this one really struck me, this Hissa Hilal, a Saudi poet who appeared on a reality TV show called Poet of Millions.
Yes, and this program is the equivalent of American Idol, but it's done in poetry. And there were thousands who applied to appear on the show. She was one of the 48 selected. And she did something very different than what normally happen on these shows. The song, or the poetry, tends to be about human life, whether it's, you know, a young romance or life in the desert. It's something kind of personal. She took it and made it political, and she stunned the audience when she walked on stage, completely covered in black. It's called a niqab, N-I-Q-A-B, and only the slits in her eyes showed. And she then walked up in front of this audience and recited her poem on the chaos of radical fatwas, or religious edicts. And this was electrifying, that someone would take on the clergy, someone would take on the extremists, and she did it in a way that was blunt and was captivating for people in the Gulf. And this, again, this is a program that goes out across the Islamic world. And she got the highest score from the judges and then made it all the way into the finals because she kept going on with these very thought-provoking, very political poems.
That to me is just so powerful. Let me see. One other, the comic book series that the Kuwaiti psychologist Naif Al-Mutawa has put out.
Yes, and this again is where you see the attempt to create alternatives to bin Laden. Naif Mutawa had five sons, and he was concerned that that his boys might in some way become wrapped up in extremism or might find it appealing. So he wanted to create a different kind of hero. So he created what's called the 99, and they are 99 superheroes, each one with one of the qualities of God in Islam. And each of his superheroes came from a different country, and one of them was from the United States. But the comic book heroes are half female, half male. Among the women, some wear conservative dress, some wear kind of Wonder Woman type bouffant hairstyles, that they really covered the range. And the idea is that each one of these superheroes will use their one strength, their asset, to improve life, to counter extremism. And of course, the nemesis for all 99 is a bin Laden type character who wants to take all these 99 qualities, all these secret capabilities, and hoard them and get them himself so that he rules. And so it's a whole different dynamic that leads particularly the young in a different direction. And there are even game parks planned. One is up and open in Kuwait, but there are five others that are planned for other parts of the Gulf, just like Disney World, but based on these new comic book superheroes.
Amazing, amazing. I actually happened to see X-Men the First Class recently, and the stories are very, very similar. That's powerful. One thing that I read about in your book that was when the Palestinian protesters began to show up each Friday in a different pop culture garb. And what amazes me is I read a lot. This was absolutely news to me. I hadn't seen the pictures. I hadn't heard the story.
Well, there's one town on the West Bank particularly that's been active, but several have followed their example. But it's a town that has been unhappy because the wall cuts through part of their territory, the wall that Israel put up to prevent suicide bombers from sneaking across, and that has been largely quite effective, in fact. But the villagers every Friday would pick one week they'd go in prison garb as prisoners. Another week they went as Santa Claus. The third week they went as the Nabti from Avatar, all covered in that kind of light royal blue with long tails coming out of their backs, the big ears. It was quite sweet. They are, again, using culture as a means of protesting.
And then another thing, a quote you have about comedy. Palestinian comedian Maysoon Zayid says, "Comedy in the Middle East is just as much about giving people a voice as giving the audience a laugh." How is comedy playing a role?
Oh, comedy is great fun. And much of it actually began in this country when Muslim immigrants came here and wanted to perform, learn stand-up, and started using it to, again, reject extremists. There are at least three different groups that tour the country, in this country. They then took stand-up back to the Middle East and did workshops there to give people an opportunity to learn how to use one-liners in challenging government or to create jokes that reject extremism. And today you have in Egypt a young comedian named Bassem Youssef who calls himself the John Stewart of Egypt. He has a mock news program with mock reporters, and at the height of the uprising he did a very funny piece about an actress, true story, who protested the protesters because it meant that she couldn't get pizza home delivered. There's another comedian in Saudi Arabia who calls himself the Jerry Seinfeld of Saudi Arabia. Now think about that a minute. The Jerry Seinfeld
exactly.
of Saudi Arabia.
A good Jewish boy. Exactly.
A good Jewish boy, that's right. And so,
as is John Stewart.
That's true. That's right. But it's very interesting to see how their reference is some of the acts in the United States, not just the Muslims, but, you know, Christians and Jews as well.
What is the status right now in Syria?
Well, Syria is arguably the single most important country now when it comes to the uprising. It is an important geostrategic territory that borders Israel on one side and Turkey, a NATO ally, on the other. It has a long border with Iraq and Jordan and Lebanon. So it's a player not just in terms of what happens inside Syria, but also on questions like the Arab-Israeli peace process. Syria's always been the spoiler. And what happens in Syria will have a sweeping effect, whether it's on Hezbollah in Lebanon or it's Syria's relationship with Iran, and of course, most importantly, what happens on the peace front. Can these uprisings actually produce greater peace, not just inside the country, but also across the entire region? Syria is a place that over the past month has probably stepped across a threshold. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia called on Bashar Assad, the president, to step down, said he no longer had credibility. Turkey has walked away from a very important economic and political relationship. The United States has called for Bashar Assad to step down, and the European Union has imposed new sanctions that will block oil sales, and Syria depends, its oil stock is dwindling. It's not large, but it's an important factor in its economy and in its foreign exchange reserves. That allows it to be, you know, to buy other things that it needs for development. So Syria is facing greater and greater pressure, and it's very hard to see now how President Assad will survive this politically. He will have to, in order to stay in power, engage in real reforms, significant, sweeping, profound, because after 6-7 months, the people of Syria who have gotten out every week and sometimes more than once a week to challenge his rule are not in the mood to compromise anymore. 2,600 have been killed, according to the United Nations, and every major city has seen some form of protest, even a little bit in Damascus.
Now, we moved in, NATO and the UN, aligned itself and moved in with military aid in Libya. Why is this not happening in Syria when you say 2,600 have been killed?
Libya has always been a quirky state, and the Europeans were motivated in part out of fear of immigration. What would happen if thousands or tens of thousands of Libyans tried to cross and ended up in Europe? So NATO was willing to go along.
And they were also worried about oil, much, much more of an issue in Libya than Syria.
Exactly. Yeah. And so between oil and the kind of spillover effect, the Europeans were motivated to join with the United States. But Libya was a country also where the leadership was disdained by much of the Arab world. No one really liked Muammar Gaddafi. And because of his involvement in the mid-air bombing of 103, as well as a French plane a few months earlier, again, where everyone died, that there was a sense that you could justify taking action against Muammar Gaddafi more so than in Syria. I think people in the region look at Western policy as fairly hypocritical because we're willing to do one thing in one country and not that engagement in another country where the obstacles are even greater. But Syria, I cannot see any time in the near future or even the distant future that NATO or outsiders will get involved. And that's why Syria will probably take a lot longer than Libya.
Mm-hmm. And as I want to remind, it was self-interest. One could interpret it as self-interest. The fear of huge migration of refugees and the fear of and the desire to get control of that Libyan oil that was partly a motivation there. Turkey is a very interesting case. Erdogan, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Erdogan
has been making this tour of the Middle East and has taken diplomatic stands against Israel. both of which are, it's kind of a new Turkey. What's going on there?
Turkey is now the most important Muslim country in the world. Prime Minister Erdogan has made it a country that thrives economically, that has engaged in reforms, ironically, to try to get entry into the European Union, and which is defining the way that democracy and Islam can be blended. His Justice and Development Party denies that it's Islamist, denies that it is trying to impose Sharia law on Turkey. But it is clear that Islamic values are pivotal in defining what the politics are about. And Erdogan is engaged in this revolution tour, first of Egypt and then Libya and Tunisia, and he may even go to Gaza, some people suggest, that he's trying to say our system of rule is a good model for what you want to do, even if not exactly. This is the kind of thing. And it's very interesting to see how the Europeans and Turkey are competing for influence in these new states, that the Europeans did provide help with NATO, took particularly the British and the French took the lead in many of the bombing raids. And, of course, Prime Minister Cameron and President Sarkozy of France went to Libya last week to show their face. And then Erdogan shows up. So there's this very fascinating engagement and attempts to kind of win more influence in this region.
Well, in a story in today's New York Times by Stephen Lee Myers, Tumult of Arab Spring Prompts Worries in Washington, one of his lines is, what would happen if Turkey, a NATO ally that the United States is bound by treaty to defend, sent warships to escort ships to Gaza in defiance of Israel's blockade, as Prime Minister Erdogan has threatened to do?
Well, it's clear that there are deeper tensions than any time in a long time between Israel and Turkey because of a raid that the Israelis engaged in that led to the deaths of 9 people.
On the flotilla, the peace-oriented flotilla that was trying to bring aid into Gaza and go through the Israeli blockade.
That's right. And the UN just issued its report saying that Israel had a right to do to engage in a raid, even though the ship was in international waters, but that it used excessive force. And the United States had brokered this arrangement where Israel would then engage in some kind of apology for the deaths of Turks and, in one case, an American. And then the government decided not to. And that's when Turkey began cutting off commercial deals and limiting the diplomatic presence in Ankara. And this is a really tense moment in that relationship, and Erdogan clearly feels that he has a lot more leverage than Turkey has had, you know, since it was created in the aftermath of World War I.
Yeah, I was curious why it took them as long as they did to escalate, and you're saying part of it was that Israel backed out of a promised apology. The other I see is that the Arab Awakening suddenly changed the relationships in the area. James Zogby had a recent piece in the Huffington Post on a collision course with Arab opinion in which he said we are on the wrong side of the Palestinian move in the UN for statehood. Your thoughts?
This is a very tricky issue, and my one fear is that as early as next week, we may see a vote at the United Nations over a Palestinian state in which the United States would veto the proposition that Palestinians have a full state, and that attention will be diverted from what are really homegrown political movements, and we'll go back to the dynamic of everything in the region being defined by Arab-Israeli, and that the Arabs will divert their own attention inside their countries from their, you know, trying to stabilize new political systems and look instead at Israel and the Palestinian question. And
that's a fear of yours. Do you think that's likely?
Unfortunately, I think the chances are greater that it will happen than not.
Now, by the way, in 1948, Israel did exactly this, didn't they? They went to, I mean, that before negotiations had completed, they went for statehood at the UN, which is basically what Palestine's attempting to do at this point. Although, as I understand it from Zogby's article, that wouldn't preempt the need to negotiate the implementation, even if statehood was granted at the UN.
negotiations are only, the only way this is going to end, and that will happen whether the Palestinians, I mean, that will have to happen whether the Palestinians go to the United Nations or not. So the danger is that the Israelis will react and say, you've done this, there's no reason to negotiate, or you're not good faith partners, that this begins to break down the political process. But the Palestinians are also frustrated because there's been no movement on the peace process, and Israeli settlements continue. And the United States has said stop on settlements, too, but the Israelis continue. So this is a dynamic that again, all of this begins to shift focus back to the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Okay. I think we're going to leave it at that. The book, again, is Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. To learn more, you can go to Robin Wright, that's RobinWright.net. This is Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. You can listen to this week's conversation, many others, anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do that at iTunes or at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can also look there for podcasts, articles, transcripts, and so on. You can sign up there or by emailing me at TEMcNally, MCNALLY, TEMcNALLY, TEMcNally at mac.com. And I send out a weekly announcement, tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and a lot of background on the issues. Robin Wright, thank you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.